Welcome back, Prepper Fiction fans. For this episode, our topic is Econo-Doom, an economic collapse that is the SHTF. Economic doom is similar to nuke doom in that it's man-made, not like a comet, and can have profoundly negative effects on the average citizen who had nothing whatsoever to do with the causes. So then, what's a prepper to do? To explore this sort of doom, I'm joined once again by Brian.
Hey, everybody.
And Jeff.
Guardian of the suburbs.
That's him. I figured this time we would look at three famous titles in fiction that dealt with economic collapses. Brian chose the book Patriots, with the subtitle of A Novel of Survival in the Coming Collapse by James Wesley Rawls. That's a book well known to many in the preposphere. And Jeff, you chose Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, again, a book familiar to many, especially those of a libertarian mindset. I chose John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, but more from the 1940 movie based on his 1939 novel, a look at the Great Depression while memories of that actual economic collapse were still fresh in people's minds. As we look at these titles, we're going to see if we can learn something from the fiction about what to watch for that might give us a heads up on an impending economic collapse. And from the way the characters in the stories react to their collapse, are there lessons that we can take to heart to maybe help us be better prepared should we have to face an economic collapse? We'll start with you, Brian. Could you give us an elevator pitch synopsis of Rawls's book, just in case somebody hasn't read it?
Yeah, no, I won't give any spoil alerts, but we have an economic collapse. Rawls wrote this back in the 90s and then recently updated it. Society collapsed from the collapse of our dollar and everything else, the power grid and water, transportation and fuel and everything followed, and society fell apart, and a survival community had pre-established a location in northern Idaho, and they all bugged out and went there to fight for democracy and reestablish democracy.
So, Brian, could you describe what caused that economic collapse?
Started back when we got off the gold standard, according to the storyline, and it just built up from them with the deficit spending for decades and skyrocketing national debt, unsustainable interest payments, and more spending, bank and corporate bailouts, funding wars, infrastructure spending bills, and that type of thing. Foreign central banks and international monetary authorities began to dump U.S. Treasury assets. Dollar lost its place as the world reserve currency.
Was there hyperinflation after that?
Yeah, extreme inflation. It went in from double digits, and I believe like 1,000 or 3,000%. You know, you couldn't afford anything at all if it was even available, which stores were closing, and the dollar was worthless. So, yeah, it was pretty bad according to the story.
So, Jeff, could you give us an elevator pitch on Atlas Shrugged? Because I've not read it.
You are missing out.
Well, tantalize me then. Make me want to read it.
A novel written in 1957 by Ayn Rand. Basically, breakdown is an economic collapse caused prices to rise, and some very smart people found a solution. However, they didn't fit the government mold of the play-by-play moochers, as they say. So yeah, there's a lot that goes into it. Got a lot more notes if you want to expand.
Well, we may. Did it kind of boil down to government mismanagement caused the collapse? And you'd mentioned that the potential solution was there, but the government didn't want to take the solution, so they just went ahead and let it burn?
Well, the cause is kind of left up in the air, but basically the Middle East went up in flames, so to speak. So the story was surrounded by gas prices here rising to $37.50 and up to over $40 a gallon.
Oh, and she was writing that when gasoline cost 30 cents a gallon. She pictured a 100-fold increase. That would be something like a gallon of gas costing $300 today. You can imagine how that would stop almost everything.
That brings its own set of calamities for the average person. That figures into mass transit and homegrown suppliers of both natural gas, oil, that kind of thing. But it's all centered around a railroad, and these people did not want to play ball with the government. But the government has government regulation on their side, so they can target individuals, and they did so in this storyline. Yeah, great flick.
I'll have to look for it. My story was John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. And in his case, it wasn't a fictional collapse, because he was actually writing his fictional story based on the actual economic collapse of the Great Depression. So we kind of know what caused it. Well, sort of, because there's a lot of quick, glib theories that aren't really borne out by the evidence, but still. An elevator pitch for the synopsis of Grapes of Wrath is that it follows the Joad family, who were sharecroppers in Oklahoma in the early 1930s. And this is the Dust Bowl period. So things were already tough for them. But then with the collapse of the financial markets, they all got basically foreclosed on and kicked off their poor farms. So they pack up all their belongings into an old truck and head to California looking for work and a better life. But they don't find that better life. They find only more hard times and other trouble. So back to the question of the cause, like what caused the Great Depression. There was the stock market crash in 1929, yes. But then what caused that? The short answer is that it was a vastly overinflated investing bubble that burst. What led up to that is a longer story too. But with far too many people involved, both banks and institutions involved in the stock market heavily, they were gambling. They were all gambling that the market would just keep going up, which kind of reminds me of the housing bubble that was going on prior to 2008. When the optimism faltered, people started to panic and it became a stampede. There were far more people trying to sell than there were buyers. Fortunes were lost, paper fortunes, because a lot of them didn't even have the real money. It was just a prospect of it. Real fortunes had to be sold to cover the losses. So companies went out of business or laid off a lot of workers. So there was massive unemployment hit the middle class and lower classes. And all of those people had nothing to do with the cause. They just had to bear the brunt of it. So the Joad family, for instance, they were simple farmers and they weren't doing anything in the financial market. They were already struggling with some failed crops. But the banks, desperate to find some liquidity, foreclosed on the farms and forced everybody to move out. So that was my story. Brian, how did the characters in the Patriots novel respond to their crisis? There's the man in the street, and then there's the main characters. They're kind of two different groups.
The main characters was a group of survivalists that had pre-established a compound type of retreat in Idaho, I believe, and they all bugged out. So a lot of them seemed to be in the Chicago area and in the Midwest. And when things got really bad, they started moving toward their compound, which was already supplied and fortified to the extreme. And as far as the public, they were basically burning the cities down. It sounded like daily riots, almost hourly riots, actually, in the cities.
So the focus characters in the book, you mentioned them having a fortified compound in Idaho. Who were they fortifying it against? Was the economic downturn creating a golden horde of marauders out there looking for a loaf of bread?
Ultimately, in the storyline, they were fighting to restore true constitutional law to the country, you know, to restore democracy. That was the ultimate plot. As far as being prepared ahead of time, it really didn't get into what they were expecting, but I believe it was probably an economic collapse. So they had some type of insight into what may happen in the near future with the dollar collapsing and prisoners were released or escaped. So you had a lot of bad characters mixing among everyone else and the desperate hordes starving and needing to feed their families and their children and that type of thing. And then you have the other ones wanting to take what they don't have.
So, Jeff, what about the man in the street in Atlas Shrugged? I thought the main characters were all kind of like industrialist CEO types. They weren't the man in the street, not like the Jode family.
No, the main characters in this were pretty much the producers, which if you have any confidence or belief in the trickle-down theory, they're the ones creating jobs for the people. The government didn't like that because it wasn't fair. Not necessarily that it wasn't fair. It's just these people did not want to play by the government games and share in their anti-dog-eat-dog concept. If you build it, you should share your information with everybody else. And these guys fought the system. So it was a more elevated level of trash, but it was going to trickle down to the people, as it showed in some of the scenarios with some of the employees of the railroad, the steel mill, different subsidies of the steel mill. There's a lot of aspects we don't always look at in a crash or where it comes from, but how it affects the upside down Christmas tree.
So it sounded like you were describing that the government who stayed in power took advantage of the economic collapse, even if it was of their own doing, but still they took advantage of it to then push for a more centralized government / socialist control opportunity. Does that sound like what she was describing?
Not necessarily a central control, but definitely the characters in the story were very selfish. So they all wanted their cut. They didn't care who they hurt as long as they got their cut. The media tried to push that scenario.
And because I hadn't read the book, who was the John Galt character? Because back in the Tea Party demonstrations in 2010, there were people holding up signs saying, "I am John Galt." So who is John Galt?
He's the leader or the original person that does the concept this book has. It's a cult-like legacy. I did a lot of research on this. There were so many reviews from so many different websites and everything that I could find. They were all real negative prior to 2010.
They didn't like the book up until then?
Well, you know, given the last 10, 12 years, I would love to see those people review their own reviews and see how they apply to today.
I kind of wonder, Brian, with the scenario in Patriots, that it sounded like you were describing pretty much what we've got going on today with the government programs and undercutting and huge amount of unsustainable debt, that I thought, well, if he was writing that back in the 1990s, we've had 25 years of still doing the same thing and we haven't collapsed yet. So you kind of wonder, would he have to revise that? Because obviously doing it for 25 years hasn't crashed just yet.
Well, that's one way to look at it. Or you could just wonder if the government isn't using this book as a blueprint. Because we haven't learned a thing, especially with the policies that we're using as far as, I don't want to call it stealing, but that's really what it is, taking money from other sovereign nations to punish them, causing a rust within our U.S. dollar. And that's going to end up removing us completely, or maybe not completely, but as the world reserve currency. We see that going on right now. It's going to hurt. How bad it's going to hurt, I don't really know. Whether it leads to the digital dollar, I don't know. I don't know what the solution is, but it certainly seems like they're not trying to rein anything in. So whether he was just a little ahead of his time, or those type of storylines were ahead of their time, or if it's just crying wolf, it's hard to know. Time will tell.
Yeah, there are some doom bloggers out there who have been sort of perpetually preaching that economic collapse is right around the corner for the past 10 years, but they still get a lot of readers. So there seems to be a market for that bad news.
Yeah, we've been falling apart for a very long time. The world has ended on a weekly basis for a decade or more.
Yeah, actually, there was a company that I used to work for back in the very early 2000s, had been founded in 1899. Business had never been good, even while I was working for them. And our unofficial motto was that we've been going out of business since 1899.
And like the furniture stores around my area, they've been having going out of business sales for 20 years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Liquidation yeah. sale. But apparently they never liquefied because they're still doing it.
Yeah.
And they always seem to do it around holidays.
Oh, well, that's the time to liquidate, I guess. Or what was it? Before it used to be Oriental Rugs. An Oriental rug store was going out of business.
Yep.
Apparently that's all they do is go out of business. So keying off of that, we have had recent economic crises, maybe not as total as in our fictional titles. And even if they weren't total collapses, they kind of followed a similar pattern of people at the top mucking things up, their screw-ups trickling down to the man in the street who had nothing to do with the screw-ups. So I was going to ask you guys if you had any sort of personal experience as the man in the street. Let's cast it back to, say, the 1980s. There was a market crash, a sort of flash crash in 87, but there was an earlier economic downturn in the very early 80s, which I think was kind of a legacy of the Carter years. Were either of you affected by that early 80s downturn?
I was a little bit, working as a cook at JCPenney. That was back when they had restaurants, believe it or not. Some people may not remember that.
I don't.
And I got laid off. Unemployment was really high at the time. It was in the early 80s. I went to collect my unemployment or to apply for it. And I stood in line for hours because so many people were unemployed outside in a parking lot. The line just went out through the door and wrapped around the parking lot. And I stood out there for hours, finally made it inside and never went back. It was just, I thought, well, this isn't really worth it. I was already broke. It wasn't going to really make a huge difference. So I went down to the recruiting station and joined the Army. That was my solution.
Yeah.
That was in 1983.
Well, you learned to trade.
Yeah. Learned how to drive a truck and I'm still doing it today.
There you go. What about you, Jeff? Were you affected by the early 80s downturn?
No, I don't have the seasoned privilege that you guys have.
He just called us old.
When I was a kid in the 80s, I was more focused on the music. The financial side didn't affect me personally.
Well, that's always good. My quick take for experience was there was what they called a flash crash back in 1987, where the market dropped a lot. Again, was the usual sort of overinvestment bubble. I was working for a company at the time in the Boston area that did architectural models. All of our clientele who bought those models were real estate developers. And those real estate developers were heavily involved in bond markets and credit, et cetera, to float the loans for these exorbitant condo projects. So when the market crashed in 87, a lot of those developers just dried up and went away. I don't know if they got in their old truck and headed to California with the Jode family, but they were just gone. So the company that I was working for, all of the customers that they used to have were just gone. So almost everybody was getting laid off. I happened to have gotten another job at what was the better company, the one that was going out of business since 1899. But it was kind of a tough time when you have to basically be forced to find another job. But I was blessed that I found one. What about the 2008 crash, the Lehman Brothers, the too big to fail thing? You had to have been old enough by then, Jeff. How did that affect you?
Well, it did affect me.
I knew it.
That was a time when I was working for a South Korean company where I was traveling all over the world. A lot of people stopped doing service on their manufacturing equipment. Service trips kind of dried up, so it was a lot of hard sales trying to convince people to pay me to come do their job.
So service was kind of a expendable expense?
Normally, it should have been done in-house. However, people just didn't understand the concept of these machines are too simple to pay me
a ton of money to come in, but it affected sales from the business standpoint. No new machines were going in, so I didn't install a lot of new machines. I was flying around on a lot of empty airplanes.
What about you, Brian? What did the 2008 market crash do to you?
It didn't really hurt me or hurt our family directly in a big way. I was a local truck driver. I was already well established within a company that I still work for, so I had the seniority. But some of the younger drivers did have to leave. No one got laid off. And that's only because they changed the definition to be economic termination. So with a lot of customers, the businesses going out of business and bankrupt and that type of thing due to the, well, I guess we call it a collapse, business slowed. Not only just the businesses that we couldn't service anymore because they didn't exist, a lot of the companies that did survive had to slow down a lot on their shipping cost and that. We lost a lot of business and it turned everything upside down there in the industry for a little bit. As far as like in the neighborhood, it was amazing how many homes people lost, at least in my area. So a lot of people were evicted, renters were evicted, people lost their homes to the banks and that type of thing. And a lot of layoffs with the automotive type of industry outside of Detroit here. So a lot of people were hurt severely by that. Nobody directly within my family, a lot of neighbors.
But you could see it around you. For me, the 2008 crash didn't affect us right away. I was working for a different company at the time. Almost all of our clients funded their projects with municipal bonds, sometimes institutional, but mostly municipal because they were half city projects. With the 2008 crash, the bond market just froze up solid. Nobody was going to float another bond for a while. And so even though all of our projects were potentially lucrative and sound investments and approved by everybody on the planet, they couldn't get funding. So everything just ground to a halt. The owner of the company didn't want to lay people off, but we really didn't have enough to do because you couldn't put any billable hours on a project that was frozen. So we got scaled back to doing a 4-day week and then I think even a 3-day week. And even then we were kind of doing busy work when we came in. So it was potential unemployment, but we all knew that they were all sound projects. We just had to have the bond market thaw out enough that they could resume again. So that was kind of a big hit.
Well, isn't that where the TARP money came back in, Mick, based off what I'm hearing from your projects, the TARP money shovel-ready jobs?
The TARP money didn't tend to go to things like in the bond market. It didn't thaw out the bond market a lot. It bailed out AIG and a bunch of other big companies. It didn't get to our potential customers to make them relax, or at least their bonds to sell. So we were still kind of between a rock and a hard place until things thawed out. And then it slowly got better. But I have to admit, I kind of got used to doing a 4-day week and kind of didn't like going back to a 5-day week.
Because I personally scored huge from the TARP projects, the shovel-ready jobs where the government paid, come in, dig up the water line, dig up the gas line, bury new ones. I got about 350 loads of fill free from the city. That was very huge in my development of my personal property, my neighbor's property, and on both sides. So we scored huge. Yeah, it was just nonsense. They tore up the street just to redo the same thing.
So after having gone through the books that you've read and your own personal experience, what advice would you guys give to the listeners to help them be better prepared for a potential up-and-coming economic downturn? I'll start with you, Brian. What's your advice?
It's the same advice as we give all the time in the prepping and survival world is get out of debt, stay out of debt, don't owe money. A lot of preppers are in a mindset that their debt will be forgiven or at least not chased. They won't chase them down because society collapsed. And that's never really been true. Even during the Great Depression, banks still went after debtors.
Oh, yeah. That was one thing that stood out to me in The Grapes of Wrath, was that the banks that didn't fail were super hungry to recover whatever assets they could. So they were borderline ruthless about foreclosing on delinquent properties. And law enforcement was still in place, so the banks had the muscle of sheriffs to force collection or eviction. Thinking that your debt will be forgiven or ignored should we have another Great Depression-like collapse is kind of foolhardy. Even if the bank who held your mortgage fails, you're still not in the clear. That failed bank's assets will get bought up by a more solvent bank, and that bank will be hungry for cash to cover the price they paid for the failed bank. The powerful are still likely to remain powerful, and they won't be feeling merciful. They'll demand their money.
So get out of debt. The other advice would be an emergency fund and maybe even not having that in a bank. Mm-hmm. So if there's a run on the banks and they have to close the door or temporarily not allow you access to your funds or maybe even permanent, having money or other forms of monetary exchange in your home or within your own person be good advice, whether that's the dollars or gold or silver, food, ammo, whatever you think is necessary. It's not a bad idea. And I wouldn't get crazy about it. I don't think anybody should keep $100K under their mattress or anything, but having access to make emergency purchases is always a good idea without relying on an ATM machine or a bank teller.
Wasn't there a study a while back that like 60% of the population, or maybe it was higher, couldn't even come up with $500 if they had to?
Yeah, or maybe even less.
Yeah, so
there's been several. I know I heard 300 at one point, and those same people were maintaining $10,000 in credit card debt.
So they violated both of your advices.
Yeah, it's not a financially healthy situation to be in when everything falls apart on you.
Yeah. What about you, Jeff? Did Brian take your two advices?
No, actually, he kind of jumped the shark on that. Don't go into debt. And believe it or not, it's going to send a shock through the system, but a lot of these young kids, speaking from experience with my own grandkids, they don't want credit cards. They don't want to buy a new car. They don't want to have that revolving payment. So maybe there's a light at the tunnel that's not necessarily a freight train, but yeah, you definitely have to avoid debt.
Well, that's pretty close to what I was going to say, was to condition yourself to live within your means, which is don't go into debt, but get used to the less extravagant lifestyle where, I mean, most people are going into debt because they're trying to live higher on the hog than they've got resources for. And that just puts you over a barrel if anything goes wrong. I mean, that's why the whole investor bubbles that caused the market crashes were people investing and trying to live higher than they could support. So once the house of cards falls, it takes them with it. That's a tougher thing to do, but that was part of why when we had the scale back of ours back in 08 and 09, that it didn't really affect us too awfully much because we were already used to living frugally. So continuing to live a little more frugally was not a huge culture shock. So, Jeff, are these youngsters just not having cars and homes because they're living with mom?
Absolutely.
So they really haven't shunned debt exactly. They're just living under someone else's debt.
Yeah, they have chosen their path of least resistance and the comfort of living at home. They still pay $40 to have McDonald's delivered with DoorDash or whatever it is, but they live within the moment, and that is a cash moment or an instant moment.
So maybe it's not just mooching off of mom's credit, but maybe not seeing the value in credit because it's a future thing. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Buying something on credit involves a plan for the future. If they're only living for the moment, well, there's no future to plan for.
Now, when the networks fail, they're going to be disappointed. That's where you have to go back to your cash or durable goods that are tradable.
And doing without the $7 lattes and the $1,000 phones and the $250 internet access.
So I guess their avoiding debt is actually only sustainable because they're living under their parents' benevolence. So because mom and dad are providing the infrastructure, they don't have to, which doesn't really insulate them from a downturn. It just leaves them dependent on mom and dad being able to handle the downturn. So I don't know if that's a really good solution, but I guess that's what they've chosen, like you said.
I have heard that the coming up generation is doing better financially. Their mindset is in a better state than perhaps ours. So, you know, to give them the benefit of the doubt, I think that once they mature a little bit, I think we may be in better shape. You know, once they get away from the woke ideology, if you will.
Well, I appreciate ending on a more optimistic note because our doom zooms are, well, full of doom. So it's nice to end on a happier note. Either of you guys have any last comments?
Yeah, I don't think the latest generation is really causing the issues of the financial collapse that we're about to face. The problem is this generation are not prepared for tomorrow or next week. As a prepper, you have to think next month. You can't think of today, tomorrow, next week. You have to go long term.
So you think they've avoided the trap that they might see with going into debt for a house and a car and a family? They've avoided that debt and they feel happy that, yay, I dodged that bullet. But if you're basically making yourself dependent upon someone else's credit and debt exposure, you really haven't avoided debt. You're simply hiding under it. If the financial collapse takes down mom and dad, their dependent young adult children are going to be just as down as they are.
I'm not sure if they realize it. I think the financial market is going to take years to figure it out, that all these young kids are not falling for their game of, we're going to suck you in early and control you the rest of your life, because credit cards are an evil, evil beast. Stay away from them.
Do you have anything last thoughts, Brian?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. According to the James Wesley Rawls novel, Patriots, it's a pretty simple formula. Just have unlimited budget for survival equipment and fortified compound. Find other people with unlimited funds willing to put in some time and money and effort in establishing said compound.
That was Rawls's advice. Have unlimited funds? Well, that's not much help. One bit of advice that occurred to me that we could take away from all three novels was that we should keep an eye on the financial markets. We don't have to totally understand it, but we shouldn't live blissfully ignorant of it either. We probably know plenty of people who are super absorbed in sports or celebrities or hobbies or even with their kids, such that they have zero clue what's going on at the 30,000-foot level with the economy. Ignorance isn't bliss, though. As we'd learned from the Great Depression and even then the 2008 crisis, what's going on at the 30,000-foot level could eventually trickle down to bite you in the butt. We're powerless to affect the goings-on at that upper level, but we can see trouble if it unfolds, if we're paying attention. I mean, you don't have to know all of the intimate details about credits, default swaps, and all of that other machinations. But if you see people up at the top freaking out, it's probably good to start paying attention and find out why. In most cases, the trouble at the top takes a little while to trickle down to us. We can use that delay to get as ready as possible. The bottom line, I guess, is to start paying attention to the big picture economy stuff, if you aren't already. Don't let the doomsayers freak you out, especially if they're trying to sell you something like gold or, well, just about anything. Just stay aware. Well, I think that's it. You guys got anything else?
Yes, keep stockpiling cash. It's beneficial.
Well, it certainly doesn't hurt because you're going to use it sometime.
And somebody will fall for it. That's the psychological side of it, is somebody is still going to tend to think that cash is king.
Well, as long as they'll part with their goods for your dollars, then you're good.
On that note, and your preps, your food, your water, your supplies, all that, with all of these doom stories or doom novels and stuff in the movies, if you have access to what you need to sustain your life, if not your lifestyle, you're that much better off and you have less to buy.
Well, that's what I was thinking. If you've already got the food, the water, the medicine, the fuel for your generator or whatever, well, then you don't have to buy as much.
And when the supply chain falls apart, you don't have to.
There we go. All right. Well, I'll let you guys get on with it.
All right. You guys have a good weekend. I got to get busy and try to get something on my blog. Bye, y'all.
All righty. Bye. Oh, and I wanted to mention another movie that I watched that was also a story set in the Great Depression. That movie was Our Daily Bread, released in 1934. It's not as famous or as well done of a movie, but it still depicts the plight of the poor, bankrupt, and the homeless. Where The Grapes of Wrath is kind of a dark and pessimistic story, Our Daily Bread is a more optimistic take on the Great Depression. Instead of the protagonist being forced to be forever itinerant and oppressed, the poor in Our Daily Bread band together to help each other and build a self-sustaining community. I'll leave a link to that movie in the show notes so you can go watch it yourself. Also in the show notes will be links to Buy Me a Coffee and my Patreon pages. If you're liking the content, and you just might if you got this far, please consider buying me a virtual cup of coffee at Buy Me a Coffee. Up next week will be Chapter 7 of Book 6. I'll talk to you then.